I'm J.G. Michael, and this is Parallax Views.
Hello, this is Mike Swanson, and in a few moments, you're going to listen to another segment of Parallax Views. But before you do that, let me tell you about my new book, Why the Vietnam War. It's a sequel to my previous book called The War State, which has lots of positive reviews, and Amazon's been out for years. But this one is a more detailed case study of how American empire, national security state operate using Vietnam. And I believe it shows also how things work today, how policy is actually made and why. So grab the book on Amazon.com, Why the Vietnam War.
The true truth about the JFK assassination was probably known to most of the major intelligence organizations within a few days, if not a few hours, of its occurrence. Which brings us to the Parallax View, a feature film directed in 1974 by Alan J. Pakula. In it, Warren Beatty and Paula Prentice play two reporters in Seattle. A lone assassin murder atop the Space Needle sets them thinking, what if the assassin didn't act alone? What if a conspiracy was involved? In this case, the murder itself seems modeled on the Robert Kennedy assassination, with its gun-wielding waiter, its elusive second assassin, and even a briefly glimpsed girl in a polka-dot dress. The aftermath, however, is pure JFK, a Warren Commission-style cover-up, followed by a series of mysterious deaths of witnesses and journalists. In tonight's film, a mysterious company called the Parallax Corporation appears to be hiring hitmen and patsies in order to commit perfect political crimes.
Hey there, Parallax Views listeners. What you just heard were excerpts from an introduction to a special BBC airing of The Parallax View by filmmaker Alex Cox, whose credits include such cult classics as Repo Man, Straight to Hell, Sid and Nancy, and Walker. Alex joins us on this edition of Parallax Views to continue our retrospective look at The Parallax View. It's worth noting that Alex brings a unique perspective to the film, as he is both a filmmaker and has a long-running keen interest in the political assassinations of the 1960s. So much so, in fact, that he's written a book entitled The President and the Provocateur, The Parallel Lives of JFK and Lee Harvey Oswald. Like our previous guest, Joseph McBride, Alex believes that the assassination of President Kennedy was more than the work of a lone nut. Whatever you may think of the assassination, however, I believe that Alex provides some fascinating commentary on this significant film of the paranoid thriller genre in the 1970s. With all that in mind, let's get right to the conversation with filmmaker Alex Cox. Welcome to Parallax Views, Alex Cox. How are you doing today?
Very well, thank you. How are you doing?
I'm doing great, and I'm very happy to have you on Parallax Views to discuss the movie, The Parallax View. I guess where I wanted to start is, how did you first come across The Parallax View?
Saw it in the cinema when it came out. I guess it was 74, wasn't it? Unless it came out in England a bit later. But I saw it in the same way as I saw The President's Man and Clue. You know, I went to the pictures.
And what was your initial reaction to the film, and what do you think its importance was to you, maybe personally?
I remember that of the films, I mean, I liked Clute too, but of the films of that ilk that came out around about that time, the early 70s, like Executive Action, not that many, but Executive Action, or All the President's Men, 3 Days of the Condor, this was clearly the best. It somehow, it told a better story. It was better photographed. There was something about the Parallax View that really resonated. And probably it was the character of Beatty was a good character, and the character of Paul Apprentice was a good character, and the old journalist was a good character. But really, it's the Parallax Corporation and that 16mm film that they show him to get him in the mood to be a killer or a patsy.
The test sequence
that which Packler just plays all the way through. It's not like Clockwork Orange, where you cut back to Malcolm McDowell and you see him watching the movie. Packler just plays the recruitment video or the recruitment film, and it's very striking, isn't it?
Yeah, it's very reminiscent of the sort of montages that some Soviet filmmakers would use. I'm thinking particularly of Eisenstein, and it has a really powerful punch that I think just hits you real hard.
Yes, because the combination of the images and the juxtaposition of the images and the music that accompanies the images obviously subverts the viewer during the viewing and turns them around. And makes them associate, and makes them start to, in inverted commas, misassociate things. It's very interesting and very powerful and very thought provoking. And also, I mean, and also, I think the thing about the Parallax View, the film itself, is whereas Executive Action was about a real assassination, the Kennedy assassination, the JFK assassination, it wasn't as well made a film in the end. It wasn't as beautifully photographed, because the Parallax View is extraordinarily photographed. And it lacked the clarity of the beginning and the end of the Parallax View, where we see this anonymous board of gatekeepers telling us nothing to see here, move on. That was very powerful. More powerful, I thought, than any of the other paranoid conspiracy American films of that period.
I was going to add to that the beginning and end with the sort of Warren Commission-style committee that says nothing to see here at the beginning, and then they show up at the end again when everything has come full circle and there's been another assassination. There's something about that beginning and ending that almost, for me, it feels like I'm watching a horror movie in a way, you know, or some kind of cyclical nightmare. There's something really terrifying about the implications Pakula makes in the film.
We inhabit a circular nightmare. We inhabit that nightmare. In reality, I mean, that's what Pakula is saying, isn't it? I mean, he was offended, as many people at the time were, by the Kennedy assassinations and the murder of Dr. King, you know. But now, I mean, we have a King commission to completely patronize and lie to us. And we're going to have a similar commission about the alleged takeover of the Capitol building. And these lineups of the great and the good, you know, the John McCloys and the Alan Dulleses of this world, you know, looking down on us from a podium or appearing on Fox News or CNN and telling us what's what, you know, it doesn't go away, does it?
No, it certainly doesn't. And one of the things I really like about the Parallax View, and I wanted to get your take on this, is a lot of people will compare it to Oliver Stone's JFK, or you previously mentioned Executive Action. Do you think, though, that the film itself, The Parallax View, I think it's about much more than just the Kennedy assassination. Of course, it's sort of about a fictionalized version of the assassination, but I think it deals with even broader themes than just these assassinations themselves, it really has this sense of despair about where America is headed and a sort of decline in values after the Kennedy years.
Well, that's interesting, and I would dispute that because I think that's sort of like the renewable virginity of America, you know, that every 5 or 6 years we're told America lost her innocence today when, you know, some blowback happened. And I don't buy that for a moment. I don't think that the United States was any more innocent while it was carpet bombing Korea, you know, than it was in the 60s when it was dropping napalm on Vietnam. There's no difference. The thing is always the same. It's that, you know, it's that system. And what the Parallax view shows more clearly, I think, than the other two films that you mentioned is it's elite system maintenance at work. And while JFK is an excellent film and conveys an awful lot of fascinating information, it's a work of fiction also. It's a work of adaptation. It takes as its hero Jim Garrison, and the audience is expected to go along with Garrison's ride. But Garrison isn't the only protagonist in the attempt to unravel the conspiracy behind the JFK assassination. And in the same way as Stone takes a position in his film that, oh, JFK was a good guy, he was really going to end the Vietnam War, you know, which he hadn't started it, but had encouraged and enhanced it and had started Operation Ranch Hand to defoliate the entire country. Nevertheless, JFK takes the position that Kennedy was going to stop the Vietnam War and was murdered by the military-industrial complex that Eisenhower warned us about having created the military-industrial complex. And executive action takes the position that big business, hand-in-hand with the CIA, bumped off Kennedy in Dallas. And so those are both films which are taking a position which you can agree with or disagree with. The Parallax View is a work of fiction. So you don't need to be upset by it or argue with it or say, well, no, I think they're wrong. I actually think, because it's not like that. So I think in that sense, the Parallax View, this is a very corny way to say it. It's not a kind of language I would usually use, but it speaks to deeper truths by being a work of fiction.
I want to hit on that point a little bit more. What do you think the deeper truths it's hitting at are? Do you think it's just about the Kennedy assassination in that regard, those deeper truths, or do you think there's other truths that it's trying to convey?
It's elite system maintenance. It says to us that anyone who gets in the way, who tends to disrupt the smoothly running system which we benefit from, will be removed. And it might be a journalist like Kilgallen or Assange. It might be a politician like the Kennedys, Paul Wellstone. Or it might be a great political and social leader like Dr. King or like Malcolm X. One thing they all have in common is they will be removed. And that's what the Parallax View is about. And the Parallax View, because it's also a thriller, tells the story of this imaginary corporation which facilitates political murder and the provision of patsies. It's interesting. Chilling. Chilling. Terrifying that it talks to a reality that we all inhabit.
I wanted to touch on that a bit more. One of the things that really struck me about the Parallax View, especially near the climax, is you have Joseph Frady, the Warren Beatty character. He sort of becomes enmeshed in this world, and there's a lot of symbolic imagery in the film's third act that really sort of shows him enmeshed in a physical sort of representation or geography of conspiracy and patsyism.
You mean when he's up there in the gantries of the convention center?
Yes, yeah, and I was wondering if you could comment on that and why that scene, that third act, works so well.
Ooh, well, I wouldn't really know how to. I mean, because there's so much complexity in it, isn't there? I was reading the booklet that came with the new DVD and Blu-ray release of The Parallax View, and the author of the essay in there points out that Beatty's character doesn't actually take the test. They find a genuine psychotic, you know, who's already in captivity, and have him take the parallax test. But really, I would think that a more than half-intelligent person like Beatty's character would be able to take the test and pass it. Because when you see those questions, you can see how you would game that test so as to appear psychotic. And so that brings up another interesting question, which is we, like the journalist, can so easily slip into that mode of thinking or imagine what it would be like. Getting back to that test again, the parallax test and the parallax video.
It's interesting because when I interviewed John Borskin, the assistant to Alan Pakula on the film, he said that one of the reasons Frady can be sort of recruited and turned into a patsy for the Parallax Corporation is that Frady has within him this same sort of ruthless ambition as the assassins. It goes in a very different direction than those assassins, but they sort of exploit that ambition he has to get at the truth. I was wondering if you could comment on maybe Borstein's interpretation there.
I would think that, I mean, it's interesting that he said the ambition, because he would know better than we would, because he was there when they were creating that test and coming up with it and planning the film, so he would know much better. I mean, it's interesting. I couldn't say anything better than what he said about that, you know, because he knew.
So, in regards to the filmmaking itself, a lot of people talk about the cinematography, the soundtrack. What are the elements of the film that really stood out to you? Because you're, of course, a filmmaker yourself. So what were the elements that really came together for you on a technical level that makes this such a great film that we need to remember?
Well, I think that one of the things about Pakula is that he's a modest director. He doesn't do stuff to impress you. You know, there's nothing in the film that goes, oh, and then there was, you know, there was this shot that lasted for 17 minutes. You know, it's nothing like that. It's everything is at the service of the story. And it's really interesting to read what Gordon Willis said about working on the film, because the film changed so much as they went along. When they started, it was going to be a detective movie. You know, a cop, you know, Beatty was going to be the good cop, you know, and trying to find out the truth, you know, but then it morphed as they were in pre-production and working on the script and revising it. So, the cinematographer thought, I just don't know what's going to go on here. I don't know what's going to happen. The nature of the thing is changing before my eyes. I know we're going to have this kind of grandiose aspect to it, and I'm going to light it very noir and very dark, but what do the scenes mean, and how are they going to be intercut, and how are they going to move from one scene to another? I don't even know what the structure is. So he decided to frame all the close-ups identically, using the same lens and the camera the same distance from the actor. Obviously, sometimes the actor might be looking left to right or right to left, but essentially the frame would always be the same, and the actor's head would always be the same size within the frame, unless it was a master. And that enabled, in the editing room, for the editor to cut from any scene to any other scene via an exchange of close-ups. And what an interesting strategy! Since they were discovering the film as they went along, to a certain extent, what an interesting strategy on the part of the cinematographer.
I was going to add to that another really interesting aspect of how the film was shot is that you see a lot of far away shots of Beatty and his character, Joseph Frady. And I almost get the feeling that that was very purposely done. It's almost as if you're watching the main journalist being surveilled. There is this sense of surveillance that permeates the whole film.
Yeah, and also it reduces his importance to a certain extent. We are reminded that he's just another little animal running around on the surface of the planet, you know? He's not the heroic character. I mean he's in the business, and as you say, he's ambitious and he wants to get at the truth because that's his business. But he's just like a little animal running around, and in the end he's a little animal running around in a maze in a little laboratory setup that they've got, so he can see his rifle and then walk through that door.
I was going to add to that as well. One of the things that I think is shocking about the film, especially for people who were fans of Warren Beatty at the time, is that he doesn't end up being the triumphant hero. We're so used to seeing Beatty as the hero that, you know, to see him sort of being manipulated and exploited.
Outsmarted. Yeah.
Could you comment on that aspect of the film and what you made of that? Because I think for the time, the way that there isn't a triumphant hero was really shocking for a lot of people.
I think that that is all to the glory of Warren Beatty, because I can think of three films where Beatty let that happen. He wasn't the director of any of those films, but he was the producer, and obviously even if he wasn't the credited producer, he has certainly had a producerial eye on things. And you think about Bonnie and Clyde, and the genius of Bonnie and Clyde, where he, although he was the producer in that instance, he took a back seat to Faye Dunaway's character. And it's really about Bonnie and her boyfriend Clyde, and that he could make a film like that and step back and let Faye Dunaway's character have center stage speaks very well of him as an actor and a producer and a person. And then, what was the other Beatty film I was thinking about? There was another one. Oh, McCabe and Mrs. Miller. Well, a similar thing happens. He lets Julie Christie be the kind of the stronger character and the guiding light of the community. And by the end of the film, his character is dying in a snowdrift. So I think that's the goodness and the cleverness of Beatty, is that he could play a loser who gets tricked into an appalling situation and still be attractive and appealing.
Also, you mentioned Dorothy Kilgallen. For my listeners that are unfamiliar, maybe you could tell us a little bit about Kilgallen and how really Kilgallen seems to be the inspiration for the Paula Prentice character, who, when I first saw the film, I wanted to add this in before you answer. It's amazing to see Paula Prentice show up in the movie and you think she's going to be a big part of it. And then
yes,
out of nowhere, you know, all bets are off. Anyone can go out at any time in this film.
Yes. Yeah. And that's a good point, isn't it? Because that just shows how powerful the blob is, or how powerful Parallax is, that it can just, people that are a nuisance will just be gone. And she is based, I think everybody says this, she's based on a woman journalist who was actually a very popular woman journalist and television personality in the 60s, Dorothy Kilgallen. Had her own TV show, was like both a columnist and a journalist. She was the only member of the press crew who had private access to Jack Ruby. She had like a 2.5-hour interview with Ruby and came out of that saying, I'm going to blow this story wide open. And famously, a few days later, she was dead and all of her Ruby materials were no longer present. But nothing to see here. Move on.
In regards to the other two movies that Pakula did around this time that compose what's been known as the Paranoia Trilogy, Clute and All the President's Men, how would you maybe compare and contrast the Parallax view to those two films? Because I feel like in some ways, Pakula's All the President's Men represents maybe some of his hopes for the possibility of reform, whereas the Parallax view represents his worst fears about where America is headed, was headed, or how America operates.
Yeah, and as we now know, All the President's Men is full of lies. Bears no relation to the actual sequence of events. That follow the money thing was never part of the original brief, and it was this guy who was pissed off because he didn't get promotion in the FBI who was spilling the beans. So it's all a sordid and wound up thing, which really seems to have existed to make Bob Woodward look good. And Paul Bernstein then went and wrote this article about CIA influence on American journalism and didn't get to write anything again until last year when he wrote something rude about Trump. So, no, I think the whole President's Men phenomenon is detestable because there are so many lies in it and because it elevated Woodward. And Clute is a good detective film, isn't it? A good detective movie with two strong central characters.
In terms of the Parallax view today, it's got this Criterion Collection release. You've given a new intro to the film. Back when it was initially released, there were a lot of mixed reviews. I think there were some reviews that said, oh, why can't we be done with all this talk about the Kennedy assassination and this is dreary, yada, yada, yada.
Nothing to see here. Move on.
Well, but now it's sort of understood to be a masterpiece thriller. Why do you think it is that this film really couldn't be suppressed? It couldn't be repressed. It has overcome any negative reviews it may have gotten when it came out and really earned its place in the pantheon of American cinema.
Because, like all good American cinema, it ends up not really taking a position. You know, you can't really take a position and say the CIA did this or the FBI is a gang of murderous killers. You know, you can't say that in polite American discourse, you know. And so so Warner Brothers, sorry, not Warner Brothers, the company in this case is Paramount, isn't it? Paramount can release Parallax View because it's not going to make any difference. Whereas Paramount are sitting on Francesco Rossi's Mate affair and refuse to let that be released on DVD or Blu-ray because it actually is a genuine political film about a guy who really was murdered by mysterious oil industry CIA allied entities. And it's a fascinating story, the greatest performance by Gian Maria Volonté, but it's about a real guy, something that really happened, a murder which really took place, a political murder. And so Paramount just sit on it, you know. And that's the difference, isn't it? That Mate is about something, so it's suppressed, and Parallax is a thriller, and so we're allowed to see it.
Just two more things I want to cover. The first is, what do you add in your new introduction to the film? What is it about the Parallax view that warrants revisitation? For my listeners that maybe are thinking about revisiting it, or for my younger listeners that haven't seen it before, why should they see it?
Oh, well, they should see it because the media will tell them that there is no such thing as the deep state, that it's invented by QAnon and all of that. And yet, at the same time, they're kind of thinking, well, why do we never get any real social change? Why are the Democrats and the Republicans so the same? Why do all the great social leaders get suppressed or murdered or ripped off in these ways, you know? Or accused of being anti-Semites. What's going on? You know, so there's a certain anxiety and a certain knowledge that things are really messed up and we are constantly lied to by the mainstream media, which I think a viewing of the Parallax view will speak to in an entertaining and thought-provoking way.
It's interesting that you mentioned QAnon, by the way, because while watching the Parallax view, I was thinking about how I've often wondered if things like QAnon are maybe manipulated or engineered, and I don't want to sound too conspiratorial about it, but part of me wonders if things like QAnon are a way to distract us from more serious considerations about concepts like the deep state and covert ops.
Well, of course, very possibly, just in the same way as liberals' version of QAnon is Russia, 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 isn't it? That the Russians run Trump as a secret agent, that the Russians control the elections, that the Russians are going to shut down the power grid, that the Russians revealed the contents of Hillary Clinton's email servers. You know, I mean, it's all, they're competing fantasies, aren't they? And they serve the benefit of the intelligence agencies and the ruling class in both cases, because they distract people from paying attention to things which they might be able to have an impact upon. Whereas we can't impact meaningfully Putin's control of Donald Trump or giant lizards from outer space prostituting children to the Democratic Party. You know, we can't influence those things, but we can influence other things, which is why we are constantly distracted.
What do you think those other things that we can influence are?
Oh, now you're asking a good question, aren't you? What can we actually change? The only thing I can think of seriously is abandoning both these political parties, both in the US and in England, and starting again entirely. I think that the two mainstream parties in both countries are rotten to the core and serve the interests of the ruling class and the intelligence agencies and the military industrial. And we just have to start a new political movement. And I think of a political party. I think of the firefighters, because I'm a volunteer firefighter. And when I'm, you know, if I get called out to a fire, some of the people in the fire department are Trump supporters. Some of the people in the fire department are snowflake liberals. Some of them are neither. And we all get together to fight the fire, because that's what's important. And I think if we could pursue that and create a political party where the right and the left are joined together, not separated by what divides them, but joined together by a shared desire for an end to foreign wars and bringing the troops home, an end to outsourcing and bringing the jobs home, and a better future for young people. I think that a left-right fusion party based on those principles would terrify the Parallax Corporation.
In closing here, the last thing I wanted to touch upon, I think you really point out throughout this conversation that there's a real emotional resonance to the Parallax view that stays with us to this very day. There's this sense that, you know, things aren't right.
It's the most pertinent film to watch right now. From a political and a moral and an ethical sense, it's the most pertinent film.
Well, what I was going to ask in that regard is, beyond that emotional resonance, was there any impact that maybe Pakula as a filmmaker or the Parallax View just as a film had on your approach to filmmaking? Because you've done a ton of great films, Repo Man, Sid and Nancy, Walker. Did you take anything from Pakula's approach to film or the Parallax View in your own works?
Yeah, I guess in the sense that I defer to the cinematographer, because I think clearly in this film, the director deferred to his cinematographer. He had a general idea of what he wanted it to look like, but he didn't know the specifics. He didn't know that the DP had made that choice to shoot all the close-ups the same, you know, so that later in the editing room they would have unlimited choices. So I think that's it, really, is be a bit hands-off, you know. I mean, just hire a very, very good person for each department head and then let them go do it. And bask in the result, bask in the environment that they create for you and the actors.
Well, I think that's very good advice. And Alex Cox, I want to thank you for coming on Parallax View to discuss the Parallax View. Are there any closing comments you have about Alan J. Pakula's Parallax View that we didn't get to, or anything you want to say about the new Criterion Collection release?
No, I think it's all, I mean, I think we had a good conversation about it. It's the second time. We talked about it before, didn't we, some years ago?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And, yeah, I think, and the funny thing is it's still current, whereas many films tend not to hold up over time. But I think both The Parallax View and The Mate Affair, which interestingly contradicts my thesis because it's about such specific individuals and such specific events, but they're events that nobody knows about. Nobody knows anything about the Italian beefing industry after the Second World War. And Rossi made the most fascinating film out of it, just as Pacula made the most fascinating film out of his material. So I think that's a great double bill if it's ever possible. We can shake that tree.
Well, thank you again, Alex Cox, for coming on Parallax Views.
And thank you for having me.
Well, that does it for the second part of our Parallax Views on the Parallax View retrospective. I hope you enjoyed my conversation with Alex Cox, and I'd like to thank him for participating in this three-part special. Next up, John Boorstin, who actually worked on the set of The Parallax View as an intern assistant to director Alan J. Pakula, joins us to conclude our Parallax Views on The Parallax View retrospective special. As always, let me know what you thought about this edition of Parallax Views by dropping me a line on Twitter at ViewsParallax or by email at ParallaxViewsPod@ProtonMail.com. Producers credit shoutouts to Catherine, Nathan, Holland, Mark, Chase, Zach, Omar, Ted, Gratz, Martin, Gary, Emilia, and Mickey. If you'd like your very own producer's credit on each and every edition of Parallax Views, well, consider joining those listeners in supporting me at the $10 or $15 tiers of my Patreon page at patreon.com/parallaxviews. That's patreon.com/parallaxviews. There is also a $1 tier and a $5 tier. Any amount will help. Your support is what keeps this show going. So if you appreciate the work I do, $1, $5, $10, $15 doesn't matter. Please consider supporting me on Patreon at patreon.com/parallaxviews. Again, that's patreon.com/parallaxviews. And with that being said, until next time, you've been listening to Parallax Views with Parallax Views. To Parallax Views with Parallax Views.
The way out is not simply to say don't do it, just to prohibit. If nothing else, if we don't do it, others will be doing it like crazy. So, you know, we have to confront the problem. But no, basically, I know of the great anxiety problems, new forms of control, but it's also new forms of freedom. This is why I always emphasize that internet and all this new digital stuff, it's a very ambiguous phenomenon, but it's the field of struggle. New forms of enslavement, but at the same time, new incredible forms of freedom. We have to accept the fight with no nostalgia for old, allegedly more authentic communities or whatever. I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid.